Okay. Whoops. Good morning, everyone. Just for those who are on Zoom today, we're having a little bit of issues with our technology here today. Our internet is up and down, just in case it goes off in the middle of the shiur. For those of you who have Facebook, you can go to Binah Jewish Wisdom and it's live there. But hopefully it won't happen, but it'll be okay. Okay. So just quickly a review from last week. We've been pursuing the concept of worthiness and the idea of feeling worthy in order to achieve connection and love, which requires also self-love. We quoted the Pasuk, the verse, V'haftol recha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, which means also healthy self-acceptance and healthy self-love, which is distancing ourselves from negative shame, as we talked about last week. Now, we looked at the chapter on authenticity last week, about being authentic and letting go of what people think of us. And just to remind you of the two great quotes that he said, one was, authenticity is the choice to be honest, the choice to let our true selves be seen. And also the second one was, you said that that was letting go of what we think we are supposed to be and embracing who we are. We mentioned the idea from the Kotzker Rebbe, who says, if I am I because I am I and you are you because you are you, then I am I and you are you. But if I am I because you are you and you are you because you I am I, then I am not I and you are not you. Right? Sure. I want to see if I can remember that by heart.
That's the tongue twister.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
okay, I'll do that. I'll try and remember. But we did explain that when we talk about being I, the real I, we need to examine and define. That was part of the discussion last week of defining what the real I is. And of course, we talked about the idea of the I being the intrinsic soul, the part of us which is unconditionally worthy anyway. It's pure, it has competency. However, the outer layers are still something we need to grow on and need to take responsibility for and work with. Okay. So now the question is, how do we do this? So I'm going to look at a chapter today, a great chapter, which he calls Guidepost Number 2. This idea of showing up wholeheartedly, of being vulnerable in a healthy way, of super okay here. Okay, anyways. Being able to accept ourselves with our weaknesses and not define ourselves by weaknesses and so on and so forth. So the number of things that we can do to help that journey along, right? So in a great chapter, this chapter, Guidepost Number 2, she talks about cultivating self-compassion and letting go of perfectionism. That's a big one. The concept of practicing the idea of letting go perfectionism. Now, just need to define perfectionism. Perfectionism doesn't mean a person who lives, I mean, although there are people like that, that live in a way that everything has to be perfect. It's not necessarily the disease of perfectionism. The problem of perfectionism can be that sometimes it manifests itself in only certain areas. So a person might not always want to be perfect, but nevertheless manifests or exercises perfectionism in certain areas, right? Like, for example, someone might be very hard on themselves and want to achieve a perfect sort of outcome in their career, or in their looks, or in their home being tidy, or whatever the case is, right? And nevertheless, in other areas, not be perfect. And the reason for that is because they suffer from the syndrome of being perfect, or they are plagued by the concept of perfectionism, which is a really big problem, by the way, as we'll soon see. But they only do it in the things which they deem important, right? Now, just because someone is not exercising perfectionism in a particular area of life, it doesn't mean that they're not suffering from perfectionism. It just means that that area is not important or not a priority for them, right? So, for example, sometimes a person can be overly driven to be perfect in their career and yet be a very negligent parent, where they're not exercising perfectionism in parenting at all, which is extremely sad because all it means is that parenting is not a priority, they just don't care, right? Whereas the career is the way they define themselves and therefore they're exercising perfectionism there, which is bad anyway, because perfectionism is a bad thing. But I'm just bringing out that when we talk about perfectionism or dealing with our own drive to be perfect, it's not necessarily only in totality. In other words, it could be in certain areas of life, but it doesn't matter. It's the same problem and we need to deal with it. Okay. Now, I thought I'd just begin today with a bit of an introduction. When we talk about not being perfect, the whole design, the whole godly design of the world and human being is about not being perfect. And this comes up very, very strongly in the upcoming festival, which is this coming Sunday. This coming Saturday night and Sunday, and Sunday night and Monday, is the festival of Shavuot. It's the festival where we celebrate the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. And in fact, it's a very important festival because it really defines who we are. Everything that we are Jewishly comes from Mount Sinai and comes from the revelation of Mount Sinai and the revelation of the Ten Commandments and so on. But there's a very, very fascinating piece of the Talmud. It's a midrashic piece. It talks about Moses going up on the mountain to get the Torah, right? I think we've mentioned this once before, but the Talmud says like this, that Moses went up to heaven and the purpose was he was going to be sent back down to earth to be the one to give the Torah to the Jewish people. And he's confronted by the angels, right? And the angels say to God, what's this human being doing here? Like, who invited him, kind of thing. So God says, he's come to get the Torah. To which the angels respond and say, the Torah, this precious gift, the holiness of the Torah, the purity, God's wisdom, you're going to give it to a human being? Human beings are lowly things, right? And they say, Tznohot chal ha-shamayim, why don't you give it to us in heaven? Why don't we get the Torah, right? So God says to Moses, you've got to come up with a defense. Like, what do you got to say about this, right? Maybe they're right. What's your answer? And Moses turns to the angels and he says like this, let's examine the Torah that you guys want. What does it say in the Torah, right? So it says, I am Hashem, your God, who has taken you out of Egypt. So you went down to Egypt? You were ever in Egypt? He says, let's go further. What does it say? It says, you shall not steal. You shall not commit adultery. Do you have a Yetzer Hara? Do you have an evil inclination? Are you tempted to commit adultery? Are you tempted to steal? He says to the angels, I mean, you're above all that. So what do you need the Torah for, right? And God says, yeah, good answer. And okay, the Torah will be given to the human beings, the Jewish people down here on this earth. So the obvious question on that piece of this Midrash is this, right? Obviously the angels knew what it says in the Torah. They were wise. They were, right? So what was their question to begin with? Why do they want the Torah if it deals with things of areas of temptation and human frailty and human weakness where they know that that's nothing to do with them, right? What was their initial thought? What was their thing? But the mystics explain like this. We say that the Torah, the way we have it, is the way it's been spoken and communicated in human language. In other words, the Torah, in its purity, is God's wisdom and operates on many levels, right? It evolved and a sort of God put his wisdom into the human context, which includes the human frailty and human weakness. But what the angels wanted, that they wanted to take ownership on the divine wisdom, not the way it's given to us, obviously in its purest form, in its undiluted form, in its form where it doesn't talk about human frailty and weakness, right? That was their question to begin with. Obviously they weren't looking for the Torah that deals with stealing and temptation and so on. But the problem is, if that's the case, then what was Moses' rebuttal? In other words, so how did he answer the question, right? In other words, they're talking about two different layers of the Torah that they're not communicating properly. But the answer is, no, they were. Moses understood exactly what the angels wanted. But he said, you're missing the point. The whole purpose of the Torah, the whole purpose of creation is to deal with frailty and to deal with weakness and to deal with imperfection. That's the purpose. The purpose of Matan Torah, the purpose of Shavuot, the purpose of giving the Torah was to give it and communicate it to a people and for it to be used for a people who are struggling and are imperfect and are dealing with stuff that they might fail at or they might succeed at, and to work through human challenges and personality complexities and so on and so forth, right? So you, he says to the angels, you perfect beings, You were created by God to be models of perfection, but you're not the purpose. You're not the intended goal, right? And therefore, Torah has nothing to do with you. Its purpose is to be given to a people who struggle, who are imperfect, and remain imperfect. And the purpose of creation is to work through those imperfections and improve, and refine, and grow. And it's given to a people who deal with imperfection in a world which was designed to be imperfect, right? You know, there's a phrase we say every Friday night when we make Kiddush. When we make Kiddush is a famous paragraph. We say, Yom HaShishi, V'Yechol HaShemayim, and so on. We talk about God creating the world in 6 days, right? And then we say, we end off the paragraph by saying, Asher bara Elokim, the world which God created, la'asot, to do. It's a very strange word. What does it mean, la'asot, to do? We should say, Asher bara Elokim, the world that God created. What does it mean, the world that God created to do? So the Talmud says the word to do means letaken, to fix. We describe the world that God created to fix, meaning that in the design, in the very design of creation, was a design of a world that is not complete, that is not perfect, right? And that's the purpose of creation. The purpose of the human being, the wholeness of the human being, is in the human being's imperfection, living in a world that is imperfect. So that's an important thing, which on a philosophical level highlights why perfectionism is a bad disease. Because the strive, the desire to be perfect, is not human. It's not what we can do. We're not supposed to be perfect. Because if we'd be perfect, there would be nothing left for us to do. Right? The idea of being here is to work on and improve our imperfection. So that's on a philosophical level. But going back to the chapter, so she describes how perfectionism is a dangerous thing and prevents real growth and connection, right? So I'm just going to quote you a little bit how she brings it. She brings it out very nicely. She says the following. One of the best parts of my work is receiving letters and emails from readers. So she writes, in early 2009, I received my 1,000th email from a reader of a book which she wrote. So I thought it was just me, right? To celebrate that, I started to facilitate an 8-week read-along of the book. I called it Shameless Less Joyful Read-Along. Okay. Just before the read-along started, I received an email that said, I love the idea of a read-along. I don't think I have the shame issues, right? Because remember, she deals a lot with shame. But if you ever do something on perfectionism, I'll be first in line. Her sign-off was followed by a short little sentence that read, P.S., shame and perfectionism aren't related, are they? Right? So I emailed back and explained the relationship between shame and perfectionism. Where perfectionism exists, shame is always lurking. Shame is the birthplace of perfectionism. In other words, the disease of perfectionism comes because of shame, right? Because we're always embarrassed to be incomplete. We're embarrassed to be imperfect. We're embarrassed not to look perfect, not to be perfect, not to achieve perfectly, not to have a home that's perfect, and so on and so forth. So shame actually gives birth to perfectionism, right? I loved her response. She said, you might want to talk about that before we start the read-along. My friends and I know that we struggle with perfectionism, but we don't claim shame. We don't claim shame. You cannot believe, she says, how many times I've heard that. I know shame is a daunting word. The problem is that when we don't claim shame, it claims us. And one of the ways it sneaks into our lives is through perfectionism, right? Which is very good, right? That's really well put. Pretty right, exactly, right? So in other words, that's a very interesting thing. So we what you're saying is that we cover up for our shame through perfectionism, but it's the same disease, really, right? Mm-hmm. Which then means what you're trying to bring out in the chapter is if we're looking at embracing our shame and not being ashamed and being vulnerable and being able to show our weaknesses and accepting our own frailty and vulnerability and others, the vulnerability and shame of others and so on and so forth, we're going to have to also let go of this concept of perfectionism. That's part of the process, part of the journey, right? What perfectionism does, of course, it leads to being extremely hard on ourselves, right? We're very hard on ourselves in an unhealthy way. And, you know, in this, she makes a few very good points. She says, we always have to understand, because sometimes we confuse two things, right? I mean, growth is important. Improving is important. And sometimes we strive for perfectionism in the name of growth. So she makes the point that perfectionism is not the same thing as striving to be your best, right? Striving to be your best means to do the best I can now. It doesn't mean it has to reach the perfect state, right? Perfectionism, she writes, is not self-improvement. Perfectionism at its core is about trying to earn approval and acceptance. Most perfectionists were raised being praised for achievement and performance, grades, manners, rule following, people pleasing, appearance, sports. Somewhere along the way, we adopt a dangerous and debilitating belief system: I am what I accomplish and how well I accomplish it. To please, to perform, perfect. Healthy striving is self-focused. How can I improve? Perfectionism is other-focused. What will they think? Right? It's very, very different. Usually different, right? So self-improvement is important. It's about what am I accomplishing? What am I doing? How am I growing? How am I improving? As we spoke about last few weeks, it doesn't mean denying my weaknesses. I have weaknesses. I'm going to try work on them. But that's coming from within. It's inside out. Perfectionism is what are other people thinking about me, right? Very, very different. And then she says that research shows that perfectionism hammers success. In fact, it's often the path to depression, anxiety, addiction, and life paralysis. What does life paralysis mean? She says life paralysis refers to all the opportunities we miss because we're too afraid to put anything out in the world that could be imperfect. In other words, what she's saying is like this, that when a person is suffering from perfectionism, it also prevents risk-taking. So we don't do anything that we might just fail at, right? Because we never ever want to fail, because we want to be perfect. Now, if you never want to fail, you don't grow. You always play it safely. First of all, you're always anxious. It's a real thing. Perfectionism really does lead to anxiety, right? Which is part of the reason why anxiety is on the rise, and so is depression, because we live in a very superficial and external world where everyone is defining themselves by appearances, by what others think and what the world thinks about us, right? Because we've lost this whole focus on self-intrinsic value. Yeah? And also, what perfectionism does is it prevents us from trying anything new. We just petrified to do anything that we might fail at. And when we petrify to do anything we might fail at, or we might make a mistake at, or we might not do it perfectly, we just don't grow. We remain stuck in who we are. We remain stuck in what we think we can control to be perfect. Yeah. You know, there's an interesting thing. A little piece in the book of Tanya. Tanya was written by the first Chabad Rebbe. It's his magnum opus. It's the foundation of Chabad Hasidic philosophy as we have it today. And there's a number of chapters there where he talks about a person not becoming depressed or upset by being imperfect, basically, right? And he balances it very beautifully about the balance between healthy guilt and taking responsibility for your mistakes and feeling uncomfortable with them to enough to encourage and facilitate and to inspire growth, or falling into what he calls atzvut, which is like sadness and despondency and so on and so forth. And he talks about different aspects of people feeling guilty with unhealthy guilt. One of the sections, very interesting piece, he talks about prayer, right? Now, prayer is actually a very difficult thing. Most people find prayer very difficult. It's very important. It's one of the critical components of Jewish living. But it's difficult. It's difficult to focus. It's the same words. It's you know, people tell me that, I know this myself sometimes, some of the greatest ideas and innovations come from in the middle of prayer, because we get distracted and we think about all kinds of different things, right? When I was in high school, I remember one of my teachers, he was describing how the Amidah is the most important part of the prayer. And he was saying how sometimes our thoughts wander. We have to try to bring it back to focus and to pay attention. So he told a story. You know, some things from school sometimes stick in your head, you know. So he said that there was a rabbi who went over to Kohen once after he finished the Amidah. And he said to him, Shalom Aleichem, welcome home. And the Kohen says to him, maybe you're the wrong guy. I wasn't traveling. He says, no, notice when you're saying the Amidah, in the first part of the Amidah, you were in China, the next part you were in America, then you were in Israel. And you finished, now you're back home, so Shalom Aleichem, welcome home. So, right. So in Tanya, he says over there, it's called Machshavot Zarot, like unwelcome thoughts, like the distracting thoughts which seem often to attack specifically when we're trying to focus on God. You know what I'm saying? Like, and suddenly we're very distracted, yeah? So he says some people find that very depressing. So they're trying to pray, they get up in the morning, they try to focus, they start off well. In the middle, these things come, and like, to the point where a person thinks to myself, like, I must be a really, really bad person, right? I must be a really bad person. Because every time I pray, I get these distracting thoughts. Now, he says, really what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to understand that they come, and you're supposed to just deal with them and try to bring your attention back into focus. But he makes a very big, a very important point there. He says, first of all, when you get really, really upset about and depressed about having distracting thoughts, it's actually an arrogance, because it means you think you're perfect, right? And you don't understand your design. So he says like this. He says, you're not a tzaddik. Most people are not righteous. There aren't people who have achieved a complete self-refinement. And he says, don't forget, the whole book of Tanya centers around the theme that we have two souls, right? We've talked about these two souls many times. That we have the godly soul and the animal soul, right? And they have tension with each other, and they fight with each other. That's why a person is imperfect. Because yes, we have a godly soul, which is pure, but we also have an animal soul that drives us towards self-absorption, egocentricity, temptation, struggle, and so on and so forth, right? So he says, what do you think? You're just a godly soul? You're not just a godly soul. You're a godly soul and an animal soul. You're an imperfect human being. And the animal soul is your imperfection, which you have to deal with and you have to work with. So of course you're going to get distracting thoughts in the middle of prayer, because you're not a perfect person. Your animal soul, every time you pray, the animal soul resists. And of course, it's going to try and implant or plant within you thoughts that are distracting you away from prayer. Right? So it's the same idea. In other words, beating ourselves up because something imperfect happened to us is a complete lack of self-awareness of who we are and how the makeup of the human being is. Right? So that's that concept. So we are imperfect, we live in an imperfect world, and we need to do things which you might fail at, because that's the catalyst to growth. That's how we learn. That's how we work. Growth comes from the struggle. Growth comes from overcoming our distractions and overcoming our weaknesses and so on and so forth. So she says that, she puts together a few sort of just insights in terms of perfectionism. She says, perfectionism is self-destructive and addictive. An addictive belief system that fuels the primary thought. If I look perfect, live perfect, work perfect, do everything perfectly, I can avoid and minimize the painful feelings of shame, judgment, and blame, which of course never happens because we never achieve perfection. So what does happen is that when we invariably do experience shame, judgment, and blame, we often believe it's because we weren't perfect enough. So rather than, this is what the human being does, right? So rather than questioning the faulty logic of perfectionism, we become even more entrenched in our quest to live, look, and do everything right. Now this, as human beings, we do this often. This is a general principle, right? I found this within many areas of life. I think I told you once, I once observed a parent that was like just parenting really badly. Unfortunately, it was the kind of person you can't really talk to because, you know, sometimes just no one knows, like, right? Can only help someone that wants to be helped, right? But what I observed was really sad, because this guy had older kids and just treated them ineffectively, completely. I used to watch it even in public, right? When it came to shul or whatever it was, right? And then it didn't work. It didn't have good results. And I saw him doing the exact same thing with his younger children, even worse. I thought to myself, that's how human being works, right? We're funny people sometimes. When we try something and it doesn't work, instead of thinking, well, maybe it was the wrong strategy, we think, no, it was definitely the right strategy because that was the one I was trying. So obviously it must be right. So I'll just try it harder. Now, if it's a faulty strategy, when you try it harder, it just works worse, right?
Isn't that the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over?
It is, and yet we all have a bit of insanity in us, right? So this was very obvious, but we all do the same thing to some degree in sometimes, right? We all convinced of certain things that they work. We never question them, and then when they don't work, we just keep doing the same thing harder. And that's so true with the concept, as she writes it, with the strive to be perfect. When, for some reason, it doesn't work, and it'll never work, because perfectionism doesn't work, which is why, by the way, it leads to anxiety and depression and things like that, because we're so obsessed with it working, because we're so worried about what everyone thinks, we're so intent on being perfect, and it never works, we just think, well, we don't abandon that perception, that faulty thinking, that to be perfect is silly. We just try harder to be perfect. And then it just works even worse. All right? So therefore, as she writes, to overcome perfectionism, we need to be able to acknowledge our vulnerabilities to the universal experiences of shame, judgment, and blame, develop shame resilience, and practice self-compassion, in other words, self-acceptance. We just have to embrace, we have to welcome, we have to work with our weaknesses and our vulnerabilities. But it does sometimes include or involve letting go of perfectionism. So here's the issue. So that's a nice theory. The question is, how do we do that, right? How do we let go of letting go? How do we let go of perfectionism? So in the chapter, she gives two strategies. One has to do with changing our own language, our self-talk, in other words, the messaging in our brain. And the reason for that, of course, is because the language and our brain messages are really important, right? And the second strategy she gives, which we're going to break down in a minute and explain, is fake it till you make it. Now, before we explain that, I want to just reorganize this a little bit. And just, she doesn't do this so much in the chapter, but I want to just clarify. We also need to realize that when we fall into the trap of perfectionism, right? There are really two areas that we need to look at, right? In other words, there are two areas where we struggle, two categories of the struggle of being perfect, right? They're both not good, they're both ineffective, but one sort of makes more sense than the other, and you'll see what I mean. The problem is that the one that makes more sense is even harder to stay away from. What do I mean? I mean like this. Sometimes we're very hard on ourselves and we beat ourselves up, right? For not being perfect in an area which has no values attached to it. It just actually doesn't make any sense. And yet we still are so worried about what people think that we strive for perfection. I'll give you an example, right? It's an example that she brings in the book for herself. She says, right after I started working on this definition, some friends dropped by my house. My then 9-year-old daughter, Ellen, shouted, "Mom, Don and Julia at the door." Our house at that time was a complete mess. I could tell by the sound of Ellen's voice that she was thinking, "Oh no, Mom is going to freak out," right? Now that's an area which we all suffer from, right? Like, we don't mind living in an untidy house, but as soon as someone walks in, it's like the end of the world, right? I don't know, they're going to think we're a bad person, we're a messy person, we're an incompetent housekeeper, I don't know, right? So I said to her, "Just a second, I'm hurried, I'm as I hurried to get dressed." She ran back to my room and said, do you want me to help you pick everything up, right? Because she was so used to, this is when Brené Brown herself was sort of working on her own quest to let go of perfectionism, but how her kid knew her till that time was, if someone knocks at the door and the house is in a mess, it's the tragedy, right? And she knew that she's going to freak out, so she ran to her room quickly, "Do you want me to help you clean up?" So that's what I mean by an area of perfectionism which is not value-based at all, right? As far as I know, there's no values attached to, I mean, there's a value in living responsibly. There's a value in living in an environment that's hygienically appropriate. If there's a couple of things out of order and a few books lying around or a few plates in the sink unwashed, as far as I know, there's no value in making sure that doesn't happen if someone visits the house, right? Nothing in the Torah, nothing in ethics, nothing that's moral or immoral about that. It's perfectly fine, right? In other words, it is intrinsically perfectly fine. And yet, people are worried about it because what is someone else going to say? They're going to say I'm an incompetent person or I'm not capable or whatever the case is, right? So that's an area of perfectionism which has no value-based concept to it at all. It's completely insane. I mean, we all do it, but it's completely insane, right? It has no origin even in something which is true, right? Am I making sense? Yeah,
What about your self-esteem?
Yeah, but if your self-esteem, no, it's a good point. But if your self-esteem comes from the fact that self-esteem has to be intrinsic. Self-esteem comes from within. Mm-hmm. If my self-esteem is dependent on you thinking that I'm a really, really competent person because my house is always absolutely tidy,
yeah,
that's not real self-esteem. That's insecurity.
Yeah, but what about the fact if you like it to be tidy and everything's in its place and you like to
Yeah, but you don't have a problem with it being untidy the last 3 hours.
No, but I never leave things lying around.
Oh, that's okay. No, that's different. That's different. That's different. No. So let me clarify. There are many people that just cannot work in a mess.
Yeah.
That's fine.
And there are other people that
can. Yeah, and some people can. No, hold on a second. But if you're a person that just likes things put away, that's fine. So you'll get up in the morning, you'll make sure that as soon as you start the day, everything is put away. When you finish your meal, you won't leave it there, even if no one's in the house, you'll make sure it's put away because that's your nature. That's perfectly fine. That's perfectly fine. But when a person suffers from perfectionism in the sense that they actually have no problem in being a few dishes left out or a couple of books left out, it's only when someone knocks on the door that it's a tragedy. That's a problem. Because it's not coming from within. It's not your personality. It's all about appearances. Right? Yeah, I know.
All the time.
Yes, and I
won't come and visit.
I got a couple of strategies, but that's a different problem. That's a problem is, I'll, right? Sorry?
People visit all the time, and there's nothing I can do about the fact that people visit.
Correct.
But I find it hard to live in that
right now. No, that's a separate issue. That's perfectly legitimate. That's who you are, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And there are many people like that, and that's okay. Right? My grandfather, who I mentioned very often, was like a Masudar. He was a tidy person. I mean, everything had a place, right? And he used to get upset if someone upset his thing. But that wasn't to do with perfection. That was to do with his nature. He couldn't work. He had to work in an orderly fashion, right? There was only one person he put up. There was a maybe you know his name. There's a very famous chazan called Dudu Fischer.
Yeah, of course.
So Dudu Fischer used to be a chazan in his shul. He started his career in my grandfather's shul. And they became very, very, very close. It's nothing to do with anything. I'm just telling you a cute story. They were very, very close and remained close for many, many years. And when Dudu Fischer used to come to my grandfather's house, he was like a son to him almost, because he was much younger, but he was like almost like that, right? And if my grandfather wasn't there, he'd walk into his study, he would mess up his whole order on his desk, and then he would leave a note, and he was Israeli. He'd leave a note, Tenachesh mi haya po, guess who was here? Okay. And my grandfather knew it was Dudu Fischer. Right? Okay. But that's a different concept altogether. That's a personality. Some people need to always be everything in place. Some people don't need it, and that's perfectly okay. Here we're talking about someone that actually has no problem living in a mess, but have a big problem if someone else thinks they're messy. That's a disease, right? Okay. And if they don't mind working in a mess, or they don't mind as long as it's not, you know, unhygienic or anything, right? Then there's no value attached to cleaning up in that particular situation. The only reason she wants to clean up is because of her own insecurity, right? So letting go of that kind of perfectionism, what she suggests, which I think is the only way to do it, is step by step to fake it till you make it. There's only one way, to actually just plunge, do it. Say like, you know, next time someone knocks the door, I'm not going to clean up, I'm just going to let them come in and see a mess. Then they come in, and we know that, we've talked about this many times. Behavior influences the person, right? When we do things, it influences our mood. If you jump into the deep end, I'm just giving this example, it could be anything, right? If you just let someone come in, even though there's a couple of things out of place, and you see that they still come back next time, and they didn't abandon you as a friend, and the world didn't come to an end, you realize that it's okay, right? So there's a concept, I mean, we've done this many, many times, the concept of the actions, the behavior we engage in influences our mindset, influences how we feel, right? So that's one strategy. So letting go of perfectionism is not just an attitude, understanding of how bad perfectionism is, it's about actually practicing being imperfect, right? That's good. But that's only, that strategy works and is good and effective when we're talking about perfectionism in an area which is not value-based at all, right? By the way, just a side little note, I was thinking about this. Perfectionism sometimes is such a hindrance to accomplishing and productivity. I was always worried about being perfect. We never get things done, right? And I was thinking back to the years that I spent by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He was a very incentivizing, inspiring person, always doing things and new projects and new ideas. Okay. And I thought about this once, about his view on perfectionism. And although he was very demanding, but he would always favor productivity over perfectionism in a very strong way. Actually, I thought about this many, many years after he really passed away, but, and looking back to the times I experienced, you know, problems involved in some of the activities and things like that. I guess give you an example. I remember once he launched a whole campaign about studying the works of the Rambam, right? The works of Maimonides. And until today, we have a custom to learn a piece of the Rambam's works every day. Now, in the Rambam's magnum opus, I'm just giving you the background just to bring out what I want to bring out. In the Rambam's magnum opus, which is the 14 volumes, or we call Mishneh Torah, where he collects in the most amazing way all the laws of the Talmud in the most organized fashion, and it's an amazing piece of work. Like a summary of the whole Torah, so to speak, right? One of the things the Rambam did not do is, anytime he mentioned something, he did not cite the source. It was intentional. He didn't, because he wanted it to be easy reading, and he wanted people to be able just to read through it and have a summary of, I mean, easy reading in his time. It wasn't such easy reading nowadays, but it was no source. And therefore, one of the ways you study the Rambam is to actually examine, like, when he says something, where did he get it from? You know, which part of the Talmud, which part of the commentaries, and so on. And there's various commentaries that do that, but there was never a work that puts all of it together. So Rebbe came up with this idea that he wants the students of the Kollel, there was a Kollel in New York that was in his synagogue, in his center, just newly marrieds that were just dedicating a year or two to Torah study before they went out into the world. So he launched this campaign of the Kollel students need to produce a book to research all the Rambam's sources and put a book, the references of the Rambam. That's what it was called, Marei Mekomot, right? And in very typical fashion, it's happened very often, I don't know what time of the year it was, but it was something like, I'd like this done by a certain date. And it was always very tight deadline. That's how it used to work. And I always wondered why. Like, why couldn't they give a bit of lead time, right? Like, you know, it's good. No, it was always like, it needs to be done by, I don't know, the Rambam's Yahrzeit or something, or by Pesach, it must be done, right? Something like that. Which would mean that it would not be done perfectly. Always it meant that. It means it would be done in a rush, and people would work very, very hard to get it done, and there's going to be mistakes. And he was fine with that. Because he always wanted people to do. There was this tremendous emphasis on let's get it done. If you're going to wait around till it's perfect, it's never going to get done. So as in this example, what happened was that it came out, there was pieces missing, there were some mistakes, not a problem. In a couple of months, they printed a second edition, and that's the way it was done. But it was a philosophy, because he hated perfectionism to be in the way of productivity. And that was lots of things. Like, he would make a campaign, just get out and do it. And he was like not into micromanaging people. He was just wanted to say, this is what needs to be done. People sometimes would ask, how exactly should we do it? Why are you asking me? Figure it out, find a way, and get it done. Right? He would give the principles, the foundations, and I'd do it. But that's part of it, because if we want to produce a perfect job, we never end up doing it, right? All right, that's just a side issue that's connected with this concept of just breaking through the perfectionism and just getting it done. But in this particular example, when we suffer from perfectionism in areas of life where it's not value-based, then we just have to do it. We have to fake till we make it. We just have to plunge in and be imperfect. However, it's not always so simple, because sometimes there's another area of perfectionism which is harder in a way. It's more complicated and nuanced because it actually is connected with something legitimate, right? So, for example, let's say we beat ourselves up not because someone came into the house because it was untidy, right? Which is not a problem to be untidy a little bit, if you don't mind, right? But let's say we beat ourselves up for a personality thing. Let's say I beat myself up for being grumpy, or beat myself up for losing my temper too often, right? Or not being a good spouse, or whatever the case is. Or not taking care of my health properly, or whatever the case is, right? There's a different thing. It's hard to say, beat perfectionism by just jumping in and being imperfect. That's actually not correct. Because that's value-based issues that I'm dealing with. It's actually taka not good to lose your temper, right? And it's not good to be a grumpy person, or a pessimistic person, or a jealous person, whatever the case is. And yet, in that area, perfectionism is still bad. Because while it's not good to get angry, it's unrealistic to say that I'm never going to get angry, right? But I can't deal with the letting go of perfectionism in the same way I would deal with it in terms of letting someone in the house where it's untidy. Understand? In other words, it's the same syndrome. Why am I beating myself up? Because I want everyone to think I'm a perfect person and a calm person and a happy person and a positive person and a big tzaddik, right? Which, of course, is ridiculous. I need to know that I'm imperfect. I need to know that it's going to take time till I work on my personality. I need to know that success in dealing with anger means that I lessen the frequency, not that I become perfect. A person loses their temper. It's unrealistic to think that in a month from now, I'm never going to get angry again. That's ridiculous. I might become better. I might become less nervous, less triggered, right? So we have this feeling sometimes of inadequacy. This feeling is like I'm a terrible human being, you know, because I lose my temper so quickly, or I'm triggered so quickly, and so on and so forth. I'm not worthy of being loved. I'm not worthy of someone being my friend or someone having a relationship with me. That's all part of the syndrome of perfectionism. But letting go of the perfectionism can't mean, well, then just go ahead and be angry. No, that's not true. It's not like letting someone to your house when it's untidy. You can't just go ahead and be angry. You actually have to work on your anger, right? So there, the strategy is a bit different. And there, I think the second strategy she mentions is more appropriate. And that's the concept of changing the messaging, right? The messaging, the self-talk. We have to play, we have to be conscious and aware of what are we telling ourselves? What's the message we're giving ourselves, right? And therefore, instead of playing the message in our brain, I'm a terrible person, I'm just shocking, I'm this, I'm that and the other, we need to change the message and do it consciously, not just like, you know, I shouldn't have that feeling. So what is the feeling I should be having, right? We should actually consciously replay the message in our brain and say like, I know I'm triggered quickly. I know it's a weakness of mine, but I'm still worthy, right? I still have a soul. I know what I need to do. I take responsibility for it and I will work towards it but not become perfect. I'm going to try. I'm going to take one step at a time. That's just very different language. So it's a different strategy in letting go of perfectionism, because there you can't just say, let's just go ahead and be imperfect, because no, it's a value-based thing. And over there, in a way, the perfectionism syndrome is worse, because like I justify my perfectionism. You know, don't tell me I shouldn't feel bad about becoming angry. I can bring you all the sources to tell you that being angry is a very bad thing, right? So it's hard for me to come to terms that the perfectionism is bad. But it is bad, because perfectionism is never a reality. We live in an imperfect world. I'm an imperfect person. So therefore, the strategy is understanding why it's bad, understanding the difference, as we said in the beginning, between perfectionism and self-growth. In other words, yes, I need to work on my anger, but not because I'm worried about what people think about me. I need to work on it because it's intrinsically bad. And I need to work on it at the pace that I can work with it. I need to push myself, but I need to be realistic. It needs to be one step at a time. And I'm still worthy while I do it. Even before I improve, I'm still a worthy person. I still have a soul, but I can take responsibility and I can change one step at a time. Right? So that's the two strategies, and I think it depends what the perfectionism is of how we apply the different strategies. And to do that, as she continues on sorry, I'm just seeing a comment here that there's some intermittent audio problems. As I said in the beginning, it's because we're having some technological internet issues. We apologize. The audio will be available afterwards, so I'll be able to get it and re-listen to it if you want. Now, one of the ways we deal with this is through what she calls self-compassion. And an interesting little thing she says that she quotes a doctor called Dr. Christine Neff. He's a researcher and a professor in Texas, Austin. She runs Self-Compassion Research Lab. According to Neff, self-compassion has three elements. This is interesting. Self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. Now, what's mindfulness got to do with it? So self-kindness is understood, right? It's in order to get rid of perfectionism, we have to have some compassion for ourselves in a positive way, as we've talked about. Not self-absorption, but self-kindness. To be understanding towards ourselves, to understand our frailties, to understand that we are imperfect and that's okay. Common humanity, to understand, I guess, that this is part of the human race. We live in an imperfect world. We're all imperfect people. And then mindfulness. Now, she says mindfulness is an interesting thing. I'm just going to explain this briefly. Mindfulness is a very good way, actually, to move away from perfectionism. Why? Because particularly with things that are value-based, right? when we feel the pain or we feel upset or we beat ourselves up, it's not about denying the pain. It's not about making as if it doesn't exist, right? But it is about managing it and balancing it. We once did a series based on a form of therapy called ACT by Russ Harris. I don't know if you remember. And he talked about the idea of being mindful means that you are aware that the pain is there, but you choose for it not to interfere with you, right? So what it means in terms of moving away from perfectionism is the following. It's acknowledging a weakness, acknowledging the pain, and yet managing it by focusing on what needs to be done now. So I'll just share with you like a personal story. Only because there's areas where I suffer from this quite badly and been working on it for many years, right? And one of the things that really is hard for me is if I do something inadvertently that upsets someone else, right? So this happened to me recently, but I'm getting better at it, so it wasn't so bad. No, I don't mean I'm getting better at hurting people. I'm trying not to get better at that, right? But a while ago, I said someone in a group that was insensitive to a particular person, and he let me know, right? And obviously he was right. I mean, it was true. Now, when that happens, there are different responses that we have. If we strive to be perfect or have a perfect image, so there are two things that can happen. One is we deny that it's true. Ach, you're talking nonsense. It was fine what I said, right? Which is bad, because we should never do that. We should always acknowledge things if it's true, right? But sometimes in the quest to be perfect, we just tend to ignore it. Well, that's not effective, because that harms relationships, that's not good for healthy living and improvement and so on and so forth. But the flip side to that is we beat ourselves up, right? So we ruminate. Oh, I was such an idiot. Why did I say that? Why did I think? Why did I put my foot in my mouth? All this kind of stuff, right? We all do that at some stage, I guess. But I did realize, and it's not just reading now the book, I've realized some other things that we've read, that the way to deal with it is to accept it, right? But to accept that it's a mistake. In other words, accept it, it's painful. I don't feel good about saying something that was insensitive to someone else. But to ensure that it's there, I'm going to deal with it as best I can. I might apologize, might be try to be more aware in the future, right? But I'm not going to let it control me. I'm not going to let it invade every part of my life. So that an hour later when I'm doing something else, I'm going to let it be and focus on what I'm doing. That's where mindfulness comes into this. It's about learning to live in the moment, how every moment is distinct from another. There's a time and place to deal with it. It happened. It's a mistake that I made. I feel bad. Which means now I need to do what I need to do as best I can. Either apologize, think about how we'll do it differently in the future, and then not let it interfere with everything else. Not being mindful means that you let all the baggage from yesterday live today. So I can't function today because I'm still riddled with all the stuff that's happening yesterday, right? So that's why that's what she calls self-compassion, which means taking care of yourself, both physically and spiritually for that matter, means to be mindful. In other words, not to deny that things are there, not to deny that things are imperfect, and not to deny when they are there and they need dealing with. In other words, it was value-based, it was wrong, right? It was stuck around. But I'm not a perfect human being. I will make mistakes. We all make mistakes.
So what about intention? You didn't intend to hurt the person.
Okay, but I mean, so that's an interesting question about intention. But sometimes lack of sensitivity is unintentional, but comes from a weakness. In other words, like sometimes we pay more attention, right? In other words, there's a concept in the Torah that sometimes God says that even for unintentional sins, you need an atonement, right? Why? Because if you were more conscious and more aware, you wouldn't have made that mistake, right? For example, no one jumps into the fire by mistake. Why? Because you know that's hot and it's not good for you. So same thing. I might hurt someone unintentionally and I didn't mean to do that, but it doesn't make it right, because it's possible that if I would be more aware and pay attention more, I have more empathy and I'll be more aware of what's going on around me, I wouldn't have done it, right? Which is fine. I don't have to beat myself up for it, but I still have to be aware that that's something I can improve and prevent even unintentional hurt later, at a later stage, or try to at least, right? But it doesn't have to take me over. That's where mindfulness comes into. In other words, I dedicate the right time to think about that, to make the proper resolution, to acknowledge my weakness, to be kind to myself and that I'm not perfect, and that's fine, I can be imperfect, and it's all right. I'm still worthy, but then to deal with it, but not deal with it, that it ruminates in everything that you do. And that's where, and that's That's where it's sort of very, very important. Just very quickly, because there's another chapter that's in this book, which I'm not going to go into in great detail, but I just thought I'll just mention it, and also it's got a particular connection to to Shavuot coming up. There's in this move away, in this being calm within ourselves and not beating ourselves up and sort of not living our lives by the perception of others, one of the chapters she has is about practicing gratitude. It's an interesting connection, actually, right? Now, I mention gratitude because gratitude is also connected to Shavuot. Shavuot, in the times of the temple, they would bring bikurim, they would bring fruit. The first fruit, they would bring it to the temple. The reason was because to show gratitude to God for the blessings that we have. But in this chapter, one of the connection to this whole vulnerability issue is this. It boils down to how we live our lives. Do we live our lives by the perception of others, or do we live our lives intrinsically, right? And gratitude is very much about moving inwards. Because as we know, the difference between what she calls happiness or joy, or what we've called in the past, the difference between pleasure and happiness, which is really the same thing, is that one comes from the outside, one comes from the inside, right? In other words, does happiness come from what people think, or how people compliment me, or the pleasures from the outside, or does it come from within? And living by embracing our own weaknesses and living with vulnerability, healthy vulnerability, and so on and so forth, is really about accepting ourselves and living from within. One of the ways to live from within is to practice gratitude. Because what gratitude is, it doesn't depend on what's happening outside of me, it depends on what I'm able to discover within me. In other words, discovering the blessings that I have, notwithstanding that things didn't work out. Learning to appreciate the simple things in life. And therefore, she makes an interesting point in a different chapter that practicing gratitude is also a contributor to living in this way of life where I'm living from within. I'm living to be me, not to who I'm supposed to be in the perception of others. I just thought I'd just mention that, particularly with this connection to Shavuot. So it's a nice little connection. We'll leave it there in the coming weeks. Just a couple of, got a few more weeks. We'll talk some of the other chapters, some of the other contributing ideas and strategies that have to do with this type of living. Have one.